Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. It is program number 787. It is January the 5th, 1987. And I have a good story for you to start the new year with. For old-time listeners to World Watchers, you'll especially appreciate this evening's broadcast. And for the new listeners, there is a lot to inform you about that explains why I've been working so hard along particular lines, and I think you'll get a better vision of those matters by listening to some of the material I'm going to share this evening. People are looking for similarities between Watergate and Reagan-gate. It's hard to find them if you don't even know what Watergate is. Watergate has a definition that means different things to different people, but for me, Watergate was a palace coup. It was a way to move out Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew. It isn't an original idea of mine. Lewis Tackwood of Los Angeles Police Department, who was part of Squad 19 and quit them because of the reasons they were planning. They were planning to kill Richard Nixon to make Spiro Agnew president with international connections to the Greek military junta and fascism abroad as well in the United States. The Select Committee, the Senate Select Committee on Watergate, Representative Pike's Committee in the House of Representatives, and Senator Frank Church's investigations into some of the dirty dealings and manipulations of our hidden government were able to expose a little bit of the power structure that was misbehaving, but they weren't removed from office for the crimes that they did. They were removed for perjury, for not telling the truth about the crimes, and then the lid was quickly closed. Reagan-gate is the continuation of the process. The same people that moved out Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew can get rid of Ronald Reagan or George Bush, whoever they want. And now the power struggle is getting more open, tighter, meaner, and in control. We observe the process and sit around and root for those slimy bastards that have done wrong so many times, such as Ronald Reagan and Oliver North or George Bush or Admiral Poindexter, George Shultz, and we watch how they get fingered for various things that they did that they got caught at. They don't consider them crimes, but when they're exposed, then they're removed. But the important thing is to keep your eyes on the manipulators, not the victims of the scandal, and I've been giving evidence of this for the past weeks since November, and I'll review my opinion on those manipulators for you in a moment. Now, at the time of the scandal of Banco Ambrosiano and the P2 and the secret government that wanted a Nazi Mussolini-type government in Italy and throughout the world, when that exposure was opened up in 1981 and the names of the operatives, over 700 of them in Italy alone, were exposed, people like Roberto Calvi, the president of Banco Ambrosiano, could be killed. He was hung off a bridge in London. Michele Sindona can be given cyanide in a jail in Italy. But then a very high team member, one of two top members of the world team, one is Francesco Pazienza and the other is Licio Gelli, they're still walking around the streets. There's an article this past week, or not past week, 2 weeks ago, in the Wall Street Journal, just a small item. Prison officials in Italy said former Secret Service agent Francesco Pazienza, who had been tied to a series of major crimes and Italian political plots, was released from prison in Turin on provisional liberty. He was extradited from the United States in June of 1986 and was questioned about the 1982 collapse of Banco Ambrosiano. Now, he also was named as a co-conspirator in the plans to blow up the Bologna bombing, where 81 people were killed and others were injured. He was part of the Aldo Moro murder and setting up the Red Brigades, and a lot of what appeared as leftist organizations being violent were set up by Francesco Pazienza. He's a close associate of Alexander Haig. I've cited some of their meetings together, of Michael Ledeen, who's involved in the Contragate, who set up the original meetings between the Israeli agents, or allegedly he did, he's the front man, and between the Iranian officials along with Saudi Arabian representatives, Michael Ledeen from the National Security Council. But Licio Gelli, After attending Ronald Reagan's inauguration, that was in January 81, he was mentioned as the head of the P2. He was in Hitler's Gestapo. He fled then down to South America, where he was after the war. Because of his work with Mussolini, he fled to Argentina and then came back to Italy to set up this fascist government again for World War III. And now he's living in South America. So Pazienza and Gelli are free. Calvi and Sindona are dead. But the manipulators seem to stay in control and stay away from the heat of the exposures. And if they want to think of a lesser crime for Pazienza, they refer to the 1962 collapse of the bank and not all the series of murders that he was a part of. Now, so last week on World Watchers, I cited an article in the Washington Post, December 1986, an Evans and Novak column. Roland Evans and Robert Novak. I'm sure you see Novak on Crossfire frequently. I watch it almost every day. And the information for the material I gave you on the air that Frank Carlucci, the new National Security Advisor, was working with Sven Kramer, the son of Fritz Kramer, came from Fletcher Prouty in Washington, D.C. I was talking to him on the telephone that morning. I usually never put anything on World Watchers that I don't see and have in my hands myself, but I felt I could trust L. Fletcher Prouty. He wrote the book, The Secret Team, The CIA and Its Allies in Control of the World. The paperback was published by Ballantyne in 1970, and it's a good book. Prouty was a pilot who, I believe, flew President Roosevelt to Tehran conferences. He was very high up in the Air Force in terms he retired as a colonel, U.S. Air Force, but he was very high up in attending these conferences, going to 60 countries, and he was a liaison between the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Department for quite a few years, from 1955, when the Cold War had escalated quite considerably, to December 31st, 1963, 9 days after Kennedy was murdered. He attended briefing conferences with Henry Kissinger, and he was very important as the middleman. These kinds of persons with a lot of skills are used as couriers or messengers between two agencies, and at the time they're working, they're not identified. And it was his information last week that I shared with you about Sven Kramer. But within a few days of that program last Monday, a listener to World Watchers in Houston, Texas, sent me the article that was the one that Prouty was telling me about, and it wasn't Sven Kramer at all that these men were writing about. It was something much worse, and Fletcher should have known it. It was about Fritz Kramer himself, the father of Sven, the man that I've been searching for 3 or 4 years. I've lost track now on how long I've been looking for Fritz Kramer. I had the General Accounting Office messenger sent him to my house, and I'll read you the correspondence we had after they left here. They were here for about 6 hours talking to me about Fritz Kramer and wouldn't confirm or deny much except to write him off as non-existent or the German Kramer dead, and they passed the buck. I'm going to read to you the entire article from the Houston Post. It's a syndicated column that was in other papers, and I'm going to read it to you because sometimes I extract an outline. But I think when you hear this story, and it takes one to know one, so Robert Novak knows one, and so does Roland Evans, you will get a picture of the White House that I have been trying to describe on the air for 16 years. This is the article from the Houston Post. It's dated there December the 24th. New staff selections on the White House, could bring up, elevate Reagan's happiness. I cut off the last word of the adjective they used on the new staff selections. Washington. The glimmer of the first silver lining in the cloud darkening President Reagan's presidency is discernible in the new staff at the National Security Council. The glimmer of the first silver lining. It says the National Security Council was the original source of Reagan's troubles, where an unexpectedly rich transfusion of blood now is raising the hopes for preserving Reaganite national security policies. The new staff selections by incoming National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci have stunned the bureaucracy. Nobody expected him to hire Jose S. Sorzano, a Gene Kirkpatrick protege, and the CIA's Fritz W. Ehrmarth, privately described by William Casey as the strongest Soviet specialist in town. On top of that hardline arms control specialist, Fritz Kramer, unexpectedly is being retained, which means that Fritz Kramer has been there all along running the National Security Council under Ronald Reagan, who has been giving out this evil empire business from the day that he became president. The article continues, that foretells career civil servant Carlucci's intention to halt policy power filtering from the Reagan White House to the State Department as Secretary of State George Shultz had planned since the Iran's arms scandal began early in November. It guarantees tough, down-the-line competition with Shultz, not obeisance from a disgraced NSE staff as feared by the conservatives. Let me just explain that again. By having Fritz Kramer at the top of matters in the National Security Council, that does away with any intention to filter down from the White House to the State Department any plans that George Shultz thought he had, that it guarantees that the NSC will be tough and there will be no competition, literally, with George Shultz, and no disgraced National Security Council will have to cow down to our State Department. It goes on, the top of the line for salvaging the president's national security policies is called the Reagan Doctrine. It was left bleeding and half dead when arms deals engineered by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North were discovered. The word is discovered. Congressional Democrats, never happy with the Reagan Doctrine's aspirations of forcing back communism at the fringes, are using the scandal to undermine the doctrine as well as in Angola, as well as in Nicaragua. Let's translate that again. The congressional Democrats, who don't like Reagan's aspirations of forcing back communism at the fringes, and one of the conditions of the terrorism policy of the NSC, not one of the conditions, but one of the things they wrote in, was attack a country before it gets dangerous. Don't wait to see what it does. And they attacked and tested the waters with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya just to bomb his place to get their own kicks to show him who's the strongest and most powerful. This column continues. This environment was shaken by Carlucci's decision to go for and get Sorzano, who fled Fidel Castro's Cuba after serving Kirkpatrick's UN deputy. He became president of the Cuban-American Foundation. It is no mere atmospheric change. Now, when Jean Kirkpatrick was our UN ambassador, she gave a momentous speech at the time the Korean airline went down, synchronizing it with lies and untruths, the same distortions the NSC feels that they are legally obligated to use if they're fighting Russia. And she has Mr. Sorzano as her protege there. And at the same time, Alexander Haig and Kramer and Kissinger have the desire to invade Cuba. Alexander Haig, as Secretary of State, wanted to invade Cuba in 1981, and they will certainly take over Nicaragua with this staff going. To continue, in shifts the National Security Council's Latin American policy chief from a highly regarded foreign service dependent on long-term relations with the State Department, will move to a tough intellectual with impeccable Reaganite credentials who is accountable to no one in the bureaucracy. And the NSC is accountable to nobody. And this man is accountable to no one in the bureaucracy, sitting there with Fritz Kramer, and Kramer having the absolute top word, being the top dog. And there is no one in our government that can speak up to him. He accounts to nobody. He isn't appointed by the Congress. He isn't approved by the Congress. He is handpicked by Gene Kirkpatrick, who comes out of that Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Abshire, who was brought in by the president to oversee what he should know and what he shouldn't know, is part of that Center for Strategic International Studies. He set it up with Richard Allen. The money came from Germany originally to set it up, and now they're saying in this particular column they are accountable to no one in the bureaucracy, and Evans and Novak like that a lot. It continues the column. Frank Carlucci, for the best, strongest people he can find with a pro-Reagan orientation, Kirkpatrick told us. He found one in Sorzeno. A similar orientation pervades Ehrmacht. He replaces Jack Matlock, a senior State Department specialist in U.S.-Soviet relations suspected by the right of Dantonism. The right suspects that wanting to get along with the Soviet Union is a crime, and there's been a big shift in the White House, in the NSC, and State Department, in the CIA, and I'm keeping track of the job changes. He was suspected by the right of Dantonism. God help us, you know. Then it goes on, Ehrmacht's work in the U.S.-Soviet strategic evaluation during Zbigniew Brzezinski's tenure as Jimmy Carter's national security advisor impressed Casey. Now, it was that time period when the Polish Pope from Auschwitz was selected, thanks to Zbigniew Brzezinski. It was also the time of the heating up of the Cold War, where they were to use Michael Ledeen, Paul Hensa, and Claire Sterling from the Center of Strategic International Studies to try to blame that disinformation on a Bulgarian Soviet Union plot. The column goes on, Casey brought Mr. Ehrmacht back to the CIA in 1984 as his top intelligence advisor on Soviet affairs, and Brzezinski is one of those people directly under Fritz Kramer. Kramer, the master puppet, holding Kissinger in one hand, Brzezinski in the other, so that if a Democrat gets in, Brzezinski runs the NSC, and if Kissinger's in, the Republicans. The column goes on, with futures wholly dependent of the State Department, independent of the State Department, Sorzeno and Ehrmacht will be tougher players in the defense of the president's policies. They are less susceptible to bureaucratic pressures from Shultz. In other words, they say they are accountable to nobody. They can be tougher in these matters. They can carry the president's policies. And, of course, they write the president's policies. That's the main point of this. They don't carry them. They write them. And they are not susceptible to any bureaucratic pressures, whether it's George Shultz or any secretary of state. And, as I said before, they're accountable to nobody in the bureaucracy. In dealing with the new, far more anti-Reagan Congress, such independence suggests more boldness and imagination in selling the president's foreign policy. They go to Congress and tell them what we need, and they can sell it. They don't need these advertising agencies or the new right to tell them, because they have the outright fascists with the ear of the president, and they can go as the experts from NSC to Congress and say, we are going to tell you this. The Russians are ahead in Star Wars. The Russians are taking over the Pacific Ocean. The Russians are taking over India. And they can get the arms and money and whip up this hysteria about the Soviet Union. Sorzeno, one White House insider, said privately, can and will go toe-to-toe with George Shultz, reshaping the entire national security staff in the middle of an administration has never been tried before, particularly one that is now on its record fifth national security advisor. Carlucci's original plan was to fire all the staffers with at least 4 years in the Reagan White House. He quickly gave that up because it would have sacrificed some high talent, including strategic arms specialist Fritz Kramer. He can't get rid of them all. And Sven Kramer, I said for years, is the liaison of NSC to the president, and I assume that Fritz took the messages home to Daddy, who then gave the walking orders, where he is with Daniel Graham of SDI and Fred Eakley, the man who worked with Colonel North and made these independent organizations that appeared humanitarian, to have the military assist in overthrowing Nicaragua, and then later, I'm sure, to invade Cuba, and they were all a part of the invasion of Grenada. Now the column continues, "This shakeup was preordained when Attorney General Edwin Meese quietly put his hand on Admiral John Poindexter's shoulder after discovering the Iran-Contra link. The president will never ask you to resign, but John, you ought to. Meese demanded that Poindexter's successor abolish the office out of which North ran his super-secret operations in the basement of the White House. That's being abolished, but he feared that no Poindexter successor, Carlucci or anyone else, would be able to build a new NSC staff capable of performing the coordinating function needed to put the policy back. On the contrary, Carlucci is proving to be adept and calculating housekeeper. Now, the important thing about taking that office out of the basement of the White House, that little super-sees-me, that secret pocket, is to put it right in the White House with the room next to the president. No more secrets, no more tough guys who are hidden with these faceless colonels. We're getting people up in the front office. And remember that when Kramer, well, I'll remind you of his military record in a minute, when he left the United States Army, he was a lieutenant. So it's pretty good that when they want to get rid of everybody, there still remains the strategic arms specialist, the hardline arms control specialist, unexpectedly retained, which means he was there, and he cannot be moved aside like the others because he is part and parcel of the fixture of the National Security Council decision-making process. Just to conclude this article by Evans and Novak, I said Carlucci is proving adept, you bet he is, and a calculating housekeeper, you bet he is, just what the president needs. He is not content with hiring a new staff capable of coordinating the president's national security policies. He is picking aides who would not sign on without a strong policy-making role. In other words, there's no difference of opinion to argue here, where one wants one thing and one wants the other. He's not going to coordinate the two different voices, or maybe three or four. He's going to have one voice, and they can't get on that ship if they don't think of it as one voice, and they made that clear at the time that the Reagan gate started coming apart. Instead of just abolishing North's operation, Carlucci abolished its parent, the political military office headed by Howard Teicher. He fired Teicher. The signal is clear. The first of Reagan's five national security advisors with a clear track to the Oval Office, not through Donald J. Reagan or any of the other chief of staff, he's going to cut a swathe of his own to heighten the president's control of his presidency. What he's heightening is a control of their thousand-year Reich, not of his presidency. His presidency can come and go like Michele, Sindona, or Spiro Agnew, or Nixon, or any of the others. His presidency means he is our front man, but they will have control. And they concluded by saying, it is a sign of hope, the first in weeks, to have Fritz Kramer named twice in this one article as being the kind of person that will have direct access to the White House, no more basement, no more kowtowing to Congress, and no more having to deal with the State Department. It's quite clear what they want. Now, who is this Fritz Kramer? Why do I keep talking about Fritz Kramer? I'm going to run through a few questions and points about Fritz Kramer that some of you remember and have, but I owe it to the new listeners to understand about Fritz Kramer. In all of the biographies and autobiographies of Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig, they refer to one man, Mr. Fritz Kramer, as the man responsible for their career. I mean, they give him credit. And in our Army, he left as a lieutenant, and he made this general and this powerful Henry Kissinger. Now, in all the policies where Henry Kissinger has moved, his Secretary of State, in National Security, in the State Department, or with Nelson Rockefeller in the Council of Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission, there has been blood, chaos, wherever he has his influence. And I typed up a sheet of this and sent it with other information at the time the president went to Bitburg. This is taken from that same sheet, so some of you have it. Incidentally, next week, my copying machine is broken today. I will send you the article of Evans and Novak, and on the back I'll put this information that you can send on to members of the committees in Congress or news people with more information on Fritz Kramer. Now, wherever the countries were overthrown, the narcotics followed. When it was in Southeast Asia, in Laos, the opium started coming in. The people involved with Contragate, defendants in the Christic Institute, General Secor, General Singlaub, Thomas Kleins, and Theodore Shackley from the CIA were all involved with opium traffic in Southeast Asia, in Laos, in the Nguyen Bank, and bringing opium and narcotics into the United States. Kissinger made policies of narcotics in Asia in this way. In Iran, where he helped Nelson Rockefeller and the CIA with the first coup, overthrowing Mossadegh and putting in the Shah of Iran. The Shah was a great drug trafficker via Marseille and the French connections. In Pakistan, when Bhutto was killed and Zia took care of the drug traffic, they've become one of the largest drug dealers in the world. Henry Kissinger changed that government. He worked closely with the escape of Klaus Barbie and was with him in the war, after the war in Germany, and was instrumental in contacts and politics in Bolivia when Barbie began to instigate his ascendancy in the cocaine traffic after Richard Nixon came to power out of Bolivia. South Korea and Japan have used Ryosha Sasakawa, the old Kuomintang gang, the China lobby, to get power through narcotics and so forth. Wherever Kissinger has had policies in Southeast Asia, Iran, Pakistan, Bolivia, Brazil, South America, Central America, Middle East, it had to do with the escalation into our banks of about $80 billion of narcotics and drug money coming in thanks to these policies. Henry Kissinger had a long association with Hitler's top generals, even though he was young after World War II. He was in the U.S. Army, CIC, the Intelligence Corps, the 970th Division, in charge of Klaus Barbie in 1945. John J. McCloy, who we know from, or you should know, was on the Warren Commission and concealed the Nazi roles in the murder of John Kennedy, released the top Nazi criminals that were arrested, and he's the gentleman who put Henry Kissinger into Harvard, and along with Peter Drucker and Mr. Fritz Kramer, they handled Kissinger's career from Harvard to the Council of Foreign Relations into the State Department. Klaus Barbie became a cocaine king, along with the government officials in Bolivia. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon were close to those men in power. He was assigned to be in charge of top Nazis after the war, when he was just very, very young, and then after that went to Harvard and was stationed in Germany at Oberammergau, Germany, which is one of the most anti-Semitic cities in Germany. Henry Kissinger's mentor was described in a Washington Post article, March the 2nd, 1975, by a gentleman who he's not around anymore. He passed away, the author of this particular document, but it's the first article, Nick Thimmisch is his name, it's the first article and probably the only one about Fritz Kramer in the United States that has been available up to this time. He referred to him as a plans officer for the chief of staff of the U.S. Army. He retired in the late 70s. As you'll see, he hasn't retired. He went from defense to NSC. He's the man behind Alexander Haig, Vernon Walters, our U.N. ambassador now, James Schlesinger, and R. Froelich. Walters also helped overthrow the government of Brazil with Frank Carlucci, our current national security advisor. He came from a German family, wealthy in the chemical dyes industry and in paraffin in Germany, probably IG Farben, because that was they had the monopoly on the dyes and chemicals before, during, and after the war. He came from a family of a monarchist. His son Sven Kramer was in Nazi Germany during the war. He picked him up after the war, Mr. Kramer, and brought them to the United States, where his political career moved on, his military political. He came to the United States originally in 1943, while his wife and son and mother in Nazi Germany were living there. He joined the United States Army Intelligence, and he recruited Henry Kissinger, who was also in United States Intelligence. And Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger were stationed Oberammergau when the war was over. As I say, Kissinger then went on to Harvard. Kramer went to the Pentagon, Both were in the Battle of the Bulge at the same time that the Waffen-SS had Hitler's top generals in the Battle of the Bulge, and one of Hitler's top generals was named Fritz Kramer. Now, the background I've given you just a few sentences comes about the one who currently runs the National Security Council. That's his background, how he came to America, just in a few sentences, written by Nick Thiemisch. Now, Adolf Hitler had a Fritz Kramer, I learned as I began to study this other Fritz Kramer. Adolf Hitler had three important men, the most important at the end of World War II, around him. One was a General Fritz Kramer, one was Sepp Dietrich, and the other was Otto Skorzeny. The liaison between those men and Adolf Hitler and the Vatican was Richard von Weizsäcker, whose son now is the current president of Germany. Hitler had all three when the Battle of the Bulge was over and America won the war by May of 1945. All three of these men important to Hitler were taken prisoner together, Kramer, Dietrich, and Skorzeny. All three were in charge of the Battle of the Bulge for Hitler after the war, and all three were stationed in the exact locations of Henry Kissinger and Fritz Kramer, who were German, who put on American military uniforms, and were located in the same location as Hitler's agents. I'll take a one-minute break and continue with the overlapping of these persons. There is one name and two persons, and I think it's one name and one person, and that's why it's important to pursue this particular problem.